From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Lots of news to get to today. We're following what remains of Hurricane Sally, which is now downgraded but continues to dump rain in the southeast. Also, in New York City, they're delaying the start of in-person learning for students in public schools there over continued concerns about the safety of students and teachers. And President Trump says his CDC director, Robert Redfield, was mistaken when Redfield said a COVID-19 vaccine won't be widely available until the second half of next year.
And then there is Attorney General William Barr's comments comparing coronavirus lockdowns to slavery. The nation's top law enforcement official spoke yesterday in Virginia.
Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders, is like house arrest. It's other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history.
Well, here was the response from House Majority Whip James Clyburn speaking on CNN today.
I think that that statement by Mr. Barr was the most ridiculous, tone-deaf, god-awful things I've ever heard.
Joining us now is NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, let's start with those comments about coronavirus and slavery. Barr mocked the idea that scientists should be guiding the political response to the pandemic. Why is he wading into this issue right now?
Well, you know, Jeremy, those remarks came during a question and answer session in front of a predominantly conservative audience connected to Hillsdale College. Barr was asked a question about the Constitution, the First Amendment, and religious liberty in light of the coronavirus pandemic. And he has been outgoing. His Justice Department has sent letters to local and state authorities asking those authorities why they are applying lockdown orders to religious freedom and religious practices. And as you heard from the reaction, the applause from that crowd last night, Barr was speaking to an audience which largely agreed with him about the importance of religious freedom and civil rights.
Barr also accused career prosecutors in the Justice Department of being political. What did he say exactly, and how unusual is it for the Attorney General to publicly criticize his own Justice Department like that?
This was a speech and remarks celebrating Constitution Day, Jeremy. But Bill Barr used his public appearance to mostly attack his own Department of Justice career employees. He said many of them are not apolitical. Many of them act like headhunters going after high-profile targets for their own aggrandizement, and that they need to be more deferential to authority at the Justice Department, namely Bill Barr, the Attorney General, who basically says he is the ultimate decider. He has some political accountability because he reports to the president, and that's the way things should work at the Justice Department. Noteworthy that several career prosecutors have quit under Bill Barr's reign this year over concerns about specific cases.
Well, and a lot of people think that he is the one who has gotten too political. He's been criticized for his handling of high-profile cases involving close associates of President Trump, including Michael Flynn and Roger Stone. And he defended himself against criticism that he had interfered with those cases. Listen.
And as I say to FBI agents, whose agent do you think you are? Now, I don't say this in a pompous way. But that is the chain of authority and legitimacy in the Department of Justice.
Carrie, do legal scholars agree with that?
Well, there are some, quite a few, actually, conservative scholars who do believe that Justice Department should run with political leadership overseeing the work of subordinate prosecutors. What's unusual here, Jeremy, is that there are now multiple investigations of Bill Barr's interventions in some of these cases. The Inspector General is looking at matters. House Democrats on Capitol Hill are looking at other matters. We have prosecutors resigning, as I mentioned earlier, and we also had two current Justice Department employees take the almost unheard of step of testifying on Capitol Hill earlier this summer, calling themselves whistleblowers and talking about political interference that they thought Bill Barr was intervening in cases to help President Trump. That is not normal at the Justice Department.
Just briefly, Carrie, I have to ask you about one more thing. The Wall Street Journal reported that Barr told federal prosecutors in a call last week that they should charge violent protesters with serious crimes, potentially even prosecuting them for plotting to overthrow the U.S. government. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the attorney general floated the idea of prosecuting people for sedition. Of course, a successful prosecution for seditious conspiracy would require not just what people think or say, but taking active steps to coordinate and conspire with each other. That's a very, very serious criminal charge, Jeremy. And a number of people who have studied this issue don't believe that the kinds of protests we've seen to date would hold up any kind of seditious conspiracy charge of the sort Bill Barr is talking about.
That is NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thank you.
My pleasure.
Congressional Democrats are now demanding an investigation into that whistleblower report, which claims that women in an immigration detention center received hysterectomies without their consent. According to the whistleblower, five women at the Irwin County Detention Center had their uteruses removed by one doctor in Georgia last year. Our next guest says, for centuries, though, incarcerated or detained women in this country have been subject to these types of procedures without their consent. Dorothy Roberts is a professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Killing the Black Body, Race, Reproduction, and the Meaning of Liberty. And Dorothy, this is a procedure that can be medically necessary. And a lawyer that represents the women says she thinks this is poor oversight, not systemic sterilization. Why do you think this story is important?
Because I think it's important to put what an individual doctor does in historical and political context, the context of a long history of forced sterilizations against Black, Latina, Indigenous, immigrant women, people with disabilities, and a whole ideology of population control that the government should keep certain groups from procreating, which is embedded in lots of aspects of U.S. policy.
You know, given some of the history here, starting in the early 20th century, forced sterilizations weren't just legal. In many cases, they were actually encouraged.
Right. So during the eugenics era in the United States at the turn of the 20th century, it was official state policy upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Buck v. Bell decision to sterilize people against their will, written into 32 state laws that deemed certain people innately inferior, and therefore it was supposed to benefit society to keep them from procreating. These ideas have been discredited now because actually the Nazi regime adopted them from the United States, and that was the basis for their eugenic sterilization laws and eventually the extermination of millions of people.
Another example of this is in the mid-20th century, approximately one-third of the female population in Puerto Rico was sterilized. What role did the U.S. government play there?
Well, the sterilization campaign in Puerto Rico was part of a U.S. federal policy to keep the population in Puerto Rico low. There are hundreds of thousands of Black, Puerto Rican, Mexican origin, and Indigenous women who've been sterilized under federally funded welfare programs. And doctors have used multiple ploys to force or coerce sterilization. Sometimes hysterectomies and tubal ligations are done without any consent at all or even knowledge of the procedure. But probably more often, women are tricked into signing consent forms, you know, by lying to them about some aspect of the procedure, like it's reversible, or in the case of these hundreds of thousands of women sterilized in the 1960s and 70s, threatening them that they were going to be denied welfare benefits or health care.
This is recent history, too. California banned sterilizations in prison without consent in 2014. But that was after this campaign of sterilizing women in prison, which included hysterectomies, very similar to the ones described in this complaint. Why in modern day, I know you're explaining about population control, but why a prison would sterilize a woman during these times?
Well, these ideas still circulate in the United States today. We can hear it in arguments against immigration that women are coming to the United States to have babies. It's part of welfare policy. There are many states that deny any increase in benefits to people who have babies after they're already receiving public assistance. That is deliberately and explicitly intended to deter them from having children. It's not surprising that you get a policy like there was in California to forcibly sterilize without adequate consent and without state approval incarcerated women who were disproportionately Black and brown women.
And we want to say that ICE says it will investigate this complaint, but that only two women have been referred for hysterectomies from Irwin since 2018. So there's definitely lots to follow here. That's Dorothy Roberts, professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. Dorothy, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for reporting on this.
Today in Washington, D.C., a new memorial is being dedicated, one to former President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was commander of the Expeditionary Force in World War II and led the invasion of Normandy, a crucial turning point in the war. The memorial was designed by 91-year-old architect Frank Gehry, who is best known for his sculptural undulating buildings. The Guggenheim Bilbao Museum and the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles are two of his best-known designs. The centerpiece of Gehry's Eisenhower Memorial is a woven steel tapestry depicting Point du Hoc on the coast of Normandy, a cliff overlooking the beaches where Allied forces came ashore on D-Day. Frank Gehry joins us right now. Welcome to Here and Now. It is an honor to have you with us.
Thanks for asking me.
Well, and why did you want to design this memorial to Eisenhower?
Oh, boy. Long story. I never really enter competitions. I did a few, but this one was looked formidable because of government stuff, and contracts and stuff are always complicated. And then the emotional issues related to a memorial. Anyway, I started reading about Ike. I was in Third Army at one point in Fort Benning, but he was president already. I started reading his history and just fell in love with it, just realized what a great man, how he managed to get three or four powerful generals to work with him to take back Europe. That was formidable. I mean, you know, Montgomery was not so easy, and Patton and MacArthur, they were all kind of had their own egos and complications and accomplishments. And so to pull them all together and in one effort and win and able to come out of it, the winners for all of them and for all of us was powerful. And once I got into that, I couldn't stop. I had to do it.
So how do you take all of that and turn it into a memorial?
Well, you go look at the site that they give you, and that was complicated. The site was in the middle of a parking lot, a parking lot in the middle of a traffic jam, and the backside of the education building and two other buildings, Health and Human Welfare and FAA. And then across Independence Avenue is the backside of aerospace. So it wasn't enticing from that standpoint. And these were buildings that were in daily use. It wasn't like they were could be just backgrounds. So that became a challenge. And I had been studying tapestries for some reason in the 10 or so years before, and realized that was the way they told these stories back then. And I thought that if we could create such a space with tapestries, we could maybe modify the site without hurting the other buildings and becoming a good neighbor to the other buildings and still making a site that had gravitas and importance.
What do you mean by without hurting the other buildings? I wonder if every architect thinks about that when they're building something in between existing structures.
I think they must. I mean, especially here in Washington, the Department of Education was started by Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. The FAA was started by Eisenhower, and Health and Human Services was started by Eisenhower. So those buildings had something to do with the person we were honoring. So you couldn't block them out. You wanted to figure out some way to include them. They were normal office buildings. They weren't, you know, considered to be architectural wonders. And I met the people that were using them. I met with Arne Duncan at the beginning. He was the Secretary of Education. And he said, please don't block our windows. We look. You know, so there were issues, you know, that had to be dealt with. And there were things that I agreed with. I mean, I thought, yeah, you can't come in and block all these guys out. Let's see if we can turn it into a positive. And the tapestry did that. Most tapestries are solid. They're woven with materials, and they're solid. You can't see through them. Here we needed to devise a way to make a tapestry that was semi-transparent, that did not block the light, that was like a veil. And I had no clue how to do it, I tell you. One of my often collaborators, Thomas Osinski, he went about creating a machine to weld steel wires so that they passed GSA requirements for longevity. And we were able to create the images of a drawing of Pontuac. Pontuac was not the intent at the beginning. In the beginning, we had a beautiful landscape of Abilene, which didn't really talk to Eisenhower's accomplishments. It talked about where he was from. And everybody thought we should be more focused on what he did. Mm-hmm. And I agreed with that. Former Secretary of State Jim Baker said it has to be Pontuac and convinced everybody. Pontuac is a solid piece of ground, solid earth. And how do you make it into a transparent tapestry? We tried everything. And at one point, one of my partners in the office cajoled me into doing a drawing. And it became the Pontuac image. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of trial and error and just dogged determination. And I think anybody had any interaction with from the beginning to now are all feeling the same way, that we, wow, what an achievement, you know, how we got through it. And you look in the mirror and say, oh my God.
Well, that must be very different than earlier on in your career, before everybody knew who Frank Gehry was and what the results of your work would be. How were your designs received early on in your career?
I had a lot of the same thing early on in my career. I was looking to make things a lot more cost-effective. I wasn't using fancy materials. I grew up, you know, very poor, so I was using corrugated metal, galvanized wood framing. And I think at some point that resonated with the architectural community anyway. And I was a curiosity, let's say, for a while. And slowly, you know, things happened. We did the Bilbao building.
Yeah,
and that was very inexpensive building, $300 a square foot at the time. Yeah, that's the other rap I get, because I use curves and stuff, that he thinks I'm very expensive. We developed a software with the Dassault systems that allow us to demystify the building of those shapes and can do them very inexpensively. So I guarantee you I'd say 90% of my buildings are on budget.
Do you think that that kind of technology that you were able to use to bring the most complex imagined forms into built reality could and should be used to make architecture also more responsive to the challenges of the day, climate change, the pandemic, inequality, things like that.
Absolutely. There's all of those things that you take into account, yeah. But, you know, you can't change the concrete industry for making concrete out of materials that are problematic in the environment, or using engines with gasoline or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think if you, the computer systems, and they're getting better and better, allow you to do things that are much easier to do now that you couldn't do then in the past. And then there's a process of, in the design process, if you want to keep on budget, is to start with the budget from the beginning to evaluate its veracity. If any building could be built for that budget. So we do a quick model of a blocky building and get a price on it. And that price becomes a base. And then we say that if you add 10 to 15% to that base price, you can create the architecture, you know, that makes it into something you want to be in and look at.
Has the pandemic changed the way that you think about designing buildings and public spaces?
I guess it's too soon to tell. Mm. I imagine it will. Everything that is in our world that's volatile has an impact on what we build and do.
Architect Frank Gehry. We will continue our conversation tomorrow and talk about what Gehry thinks of most of today's architecture and why he loves designing concert halls like the Disney Hall in Los Angeles. That's where the music you're hearing right now comes from. You can see photos of the new Eisenhower Memorial and some of Gehry's other work at hereandnow.org.
Historic peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government are underway in Doha, Qatar. It is the first time the two sides have met face-to-face after decades of war. Earlier this week, I spoke with the BBC's Sikandar Kermani about the talks. He joined us on Skype from Islamabad. Our conversation continues today with his thoughts about how both sides see Afghanistan's future.
On the one side, you have the Taliban, who believe in this theocratic-based society where their interpretation of Sharia law is the dominant form of law in the country. They call themselves the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. The Emirate is a kind of a religious theocratic state. And on the other side, you've got the more modern, more democratic Afghanistan that's been created over the past two decades. So there are huge concerns about where this process will lead to in terms of democracy. And, of course, in terms of issues such as women's rights, because when the Taliban were in power in the 1990s, women weren't allowed to go to work, they weren't allowed to go to school. So lots of Afghan women have lots of concerns that in this peace process, everyone wants to see peace, but what could the price of that peace be?
The goal, of course, is ending decades of war in Afghanistan, and that includes the American military action there that started after the 9/11 attacks 19 years ago. What role does the U.S. legacy in Afghanistan play in these talks?
Well, the United States has really been the driving force in this peace process. You might remember that it was back in February, also in Doha, that the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban. Now, that agreement was basically a withdrawal agreement. It set out a provisional timetable for the pulling out of all foreign forces from Afghanistan in exchange for guarantees from the Taliban that they wouldn't allow groups like al-Qaeda to operate in their territory. Since that agreement in February, the United States has tried to take a step back from this because they've said, right, this is now for Afghan officials and the Taliban, for you to decide the future of this country. And we heard U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo say that on Saturday, that this now has to be an Afghan-led peace process. Interestingly, he also, though, said that it's not for us or the West to impose any form of government on Afghanistan. But he said, I would caution you that the U.S. future relationship with Afghanistan will be dependent on what kind of regime there is in the future. And that really basically means, look, do what you want with Afghanistan. But if you create a government that doesn't kind of adhere to international norms on human rights, on women's rights, then don't expect us to be investing large amounts in the country or giving you large amounts of aid. And so diplomats really see that as the best form of leverage. It's kind of dangling a carrot in front of the Taliban rather than trying to beat them with a stick.
We've been talking for the last 19 years about American military withdrawal. What's the latest on this idea?
So President Trump is very clear. He wants American troops out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. He's already said that by the time of the election in November, they're going to be really the lowest levels they've ever been since 9/11, more or less. Some Afghans do worry that that means that it's the Taliban really with the upper hand, because they know the Americans are going, and it reduces the leverage that the Afghan government has in these negotiations.
The BBC's Sikandar Karmani. Today, many people on the West Coast are still unable to return to their homes because of the fires. Some small towns in Oregon are now mostly gone, and families are assessing what to do next. The Collins family has been through this before. They lost their home in Magalia, California during the Camp Fire in 2018, and they relocated to Roseburg, Oregon, and they're dealing with fire again. Nikki Collins joins us now. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Thank you so much for asking. And your 15-year-old daughter, Summer, joins us as well. Welcome, Summer.
Thank you.
The fires are still a good 20 miles away from where you all are, but it's burning in all directions from where you live. How is your family impacted, Nikki?
The emotional impact of seeing the smoke and smelling it and seeing news clips of the fires, it's draining. I cry a lot over it. The neighbors have been asking me what to pack. My youngest one, Clayton, my six-year-old, he seems to be more affected than the older two. He's still trying to process what happened with the campfire, so he's really worried that the fires are going to hit here and we're going to lose everything again.
Summer, along with the fires, we're also living through a pandemic. What has school been like for you?
It's been harder because it's all online, so we have to do like Zoom meetings, and then we're using something called Canvas, which is a little bit harder than normal school.
Yeah, when you're not doing your schoolwork, what's your day-to-day been like since the fires have begun?
Usually I just paint or draw, maybe watch some TV.
Yeah, that's just about the extent that you can do at this time. You all moved to Oregon about a year ago, as I mentioned, but now you're actually planning to move back to California. Nikki, why?
All of our friends and family are still down there. We feel isolated up here. We haven't really met anyone up here in Oregon. The only thing that feels normal to us is my husband races, so we go to the local racetracks. But since we've moved up here, we've been down in California at least once or twice a month to just see our family and friends. Mm-hmm. And no matter if we're in Oregon at this point or California, there's fires. At this point, it's just feeling like we cannot escape these fires. So if we're going to go through this, we might as well go through it back at home in California with, you know, friends and family, people we love and care about.
How do you prepare logistically for this kind of situation? What have you learned about being ready for fires?
Always have your important documents in one place. Make sure they're not scattered, because if you lose your home like we did, those important documents come in handy when you're trying to rebuild your life and get things settled and going through the FEMA process. Animals, make sure your animals are with you and you have food with them. And always, always try to make sure you have a bag of clothes packed. And the best advice for clothes I can give is take the clothes out of your dirty clothes hamper. Those are the clothes you like and wear the most. So don't grab anything off the closet shelf.
That is very sound advice. It is really sound advice for sure. Nikki, you mentioned that you've been crying a lot. You're a mama, but you're also a human. I know you still talk with a mental health counselor. What else do you do to cope with all of this uncertainty?
Reading is a big thing. I love to read, so I try to read. But I also have to remember that even though there are fires all around us, we are prepared. And I still have three kids I have to take care of and animals I have to take care of. I can't be down and crying all the time. I still have to be a mother and a wife. That's just how it is. There's no getting around it. You have to push yourself to keep going. Seeing the mental health counselor, though, has been a huge help for me.
You know, we don't always talk about people's resiliency after a horrific tragedy like a fire or really the death of so many people from this pandemic. Why do you think that is? And how can we celebrate someone's ability to rise above it all?
I think people are afraid of the unknown. And from my experience, people in the town of Paradise, Magalia, Concow, we knew what it was, but we didn't know how to act upon that and to rise above because we had never been through anything like that. When you lose a town, the whole town comes together. They pull for each other and they're there for each other. I don't know how we all did it, but somehow we just rised above. You need to be there for other people, and those other people are usually going to be there for you too.
Nikki Collins and her daughter Summer lost their home in the Camp Fire in Northern California in 2018. It's almost been 2 years now since that fire, and they're now living in Oregon. Thank you both so much for taking the time to share how you're getting through this, and stay safe.
Thank you for having us. We really appreciated it, and it was great talking to you.
Air travel has fallen drastically in the pandemic. In Hawaii, the number of daily passengers is down more than 90% from last year. That has gutted the state's tourism-dependent economy. Leaders in Hawaii have been looking for ways to safely bring tourists back and recently unveiled a new feature at local airports. Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty reports.
All international and continental U.S. travelers are required to stay home or in their hotel room for 14 days after arrival and monitor their health.
The concourses at Daniel K. Inouye International Airport in Honolulu are mostly empty these days. This time last year, more than 30,000 people were arriving in Hawaii every day. Now, there are fewer than 2,000. Hawaii was the first state in the country to enact a travel quarantine. Anyone arriving in the islands is required to self-isolate at home or a hotel for 14 days. Travelers who are still coming now have their body temperature checked by special thermal cameras, part of the effort to prevent anyone infected with COVID-19 from bringing the virus to Hawaii. While deplaning, passengers are scanned and flagged if they have a temperature higher than 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Tim Sakahara is with the Hawaii Department of Transportation.
In those situations, that passenger will be pulled aside for an additional evaluation, in addition to having the option of having a COVID-19 test taken here at the airport.
Passengers found to have COVID are directed to isolate for 2 weeks. The Hawaii Department of Health says it makes daily phone calls to monitor the condition of positive individuals and ensure they're staying at home.
Keep folks distance, please. Keep folks distance.
On a full flight from San Francisco, masked passengers walk up the jetway at normal speed and exited into the concourse without having to slow down or bunch up.
Please keep you guys distance, please.
Previously, National Guard troops had to check each arriving passenger individually. But Bill Carlton with NEC says this type of system is much more efficient than scanning passengers by hand.
So instead of taking half an hour or 40 minutes sometimes to offload 200 passengers on a flight, now they're doing it inside of 10 or 12 minutes.
The cameras also allow screeners to avoid close contact with travelers, although they're still present to check passengers who might not register, like small children or people in wheelchairs. Of course, not everyone with COVID will have a fever or even display symptoms at all. But this type of symptom check can still produce a measurable impact, says Tim Brown, who studies epidemics at the East-West Center in Honolulu.
Airport screening for temperature and symptoms picked up about 32.7% of those cases. So one-third, basically.
That number comes from a study in Taiwan in which all arriving passengers were tested and quarantined in addition to getting a temperature check. Brown says if thermal screening is paired with mandatory pre-flight testing for the virus, as many as 90% of infected individuals could be identified. But the idea is not without controversy. While phase one of the project only covers thermal screening, phase two of the project will incorporate a facial recognition camera to help screeners verify which passengers are running a fever. That has civil rights watchdogs like the ACLU of Hawaii's Mateo Caballero on alert.
We have concerns about the constitutionality of the technology, particularly here in Hawaii, where there is a specific right to privacy recognized in the Hawaii Constitution.
The Transportation Department's Tim Sakahara says only passengers running a temperature will have their photo taken, and the state is taking steps to protect travelers' privacy.
It's only going to be kept on record for 30 minutes, and then it'll be purged and deleted. The picture itself will not identify that person. It won't know that person's name, won't know their address, where they live, certainly not something like their social security number. None of that will be known.
The ultimate goal of using facial capture is to have screeners be even further removed from a potentially sick passenger. The system would detect a traveler with a fever, take their photo, and send it to a designated response team elsewhere in the terminal. But for now, it's only checking temperatures. The facial recognition component won't be ready until December. For Here and Now, I'm Ryan Finnerty.
There's some good news this week for college football fans. They'll be able to watch Big Ten games this fall. Yesterday, the league reversed its decision to cancel the season because of COVID-19. Mike Pesca is Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So the Big Ten Conference is one of the most prominent leagues in college sports. It includes big schools like Ohio State, Michigan, Nebraska. Why did it change its mind?
Well, you did say good news for college football fans, and that's probably true. The fans love their football. I'm not sure that it's good news for public health. What happened, and there is a reason, it's not just shifting wins or jealousy over the NFL starting and seeming to go well. The league was able to, all leagues were able to, secure rapid testing. So this means that players, it will be known almost immediately or at least within 24 hours if a player tests positive. This gives them a lot more leeway to pull players off the field. However, and especially in a lot of these states in the upper Midwest, the outbreak is far from contained and there still is a lot of risk. They're taking the calculation that the risk is worth the reward, and the reward is big. There's a lot of money at stake. And I don't mean to cast an aspersion about the cynicism of play. Money's important, and this is, I guess, a microcosm of the overall debate between the economy and opening up. Mm-hmm. And right now, this division leaves only the Pac-12 as the one huge division that is saying no college football.
Well, we've already heard that more than 1,800 students at the University of Iowa, which is a Big Ten school, have tested positive for COVID-19. What about college basketball? March Madness, the men's and women's college basketball tournaments were among the first really major events canceled many months ago because of the pandemic. Is there going to be a college basketball season this year?
Again, they say yes. And the idea of making a bubble on the college basketball, which has much smaller rosters, that seems much more doable. I mean, to give you the size, a comparison of the size of college football and college basketball, Texas Tech has had 75 players test positive for COVID-19, their football team. So you might be saying, oh, my God, how many players are on Texas Tech's roster if 75 test positive? The answer is well over 100. So we're really talking an order of magnitude. And if the pandemic doesn't come sweeping back with flu season, it would seem that college basketball could follow the pro basketball model, do some bubbling, and maybe have season play and even a tournament.
One of the things that all kinds of leagues have done to try to make things look normal if they've got no fans in the stadiums is they're pumping in fake crowd noise. And I must say, sometimes it actually works pretty well. But the NFL had a problem with that in several games over the weekend. What happened?
Yes. Well, all the leagues are experimenting to one degree or another. And I saw some early soccer games. One of the channels broadcasting it used the fake crowd noise and the other didn't. And when it didn't, it just seemed ghostly and unnatural, meaning that the actual unnatural pumped in crowd noise made it seem more legitimate. But a lot of these audio engineers who are in charge of, you know, making the crowd cheer when a touchdown is scored or boo when a call goes against the home team are either asleep at the switch or pressing the wrong buttons. So you had these specters or whatever the audio specter is of a team going ahead for a score, and they're just being absolutely not even a murmur of consent to that.
I mean, the other option is it could be just really a hard job to do that because it's not really been done in a live setting before. Maybe they're not asleep at the switch. Mike, let's talk about baseball. The LA Dodgers became the first team to clinch a playoff berth with their win last night. But if the Dodgers make it to the World Series, they won't be playing their games in LA. How's that going to work?
Well, the first set of games, and 16 teams are making the playoffs, there'll be a home field advantage where the home team plays all the games. And then every team, once they get down to eight, are going to go to four bubbles. And then finally, the World Series will be held in one place in the Texas Rangers' new stadium. But the other kind of downside to this is the Dodgers have clinched a playoffs berth, and normally they'd want to play harder to get an actual home field advantage, but there's almost no incentive. So the Dodgers manager has admitted, yeah, we're just going to rest pitchers, try out young players. We're sort of coasting for the rest of the season because it doesn't matter if we're the number one seed or the number eight seed.
Mike, WNBA players are responding to the $12 million settlement this week between the city of Louisville and the family of Breonna Taylor, the young black woman killed by police in March. Several players are saying the settlement isn't good enough.
Right. And this, you know, echoes a lot of social justice concerns. Oprah Winfrey taking out a series of billboards calling for the arrest of the police. This is, of course, an issue much bigger than what the WNBA can demand. But we should note that all the leagues have made strides, and I think more than just lip service, to some form of police reform or some form of at least looking inwards as to the state of racism in America. I would say the WNBA leads the way. The WNBA has players who've, you know, taken off the whole season to work for the exoneration of inmates. And in this case, they're really putting themselves out there a little bit more. This is not just a platitude. This is talking about arresting officers of the law for this for the killing of Breonna Taylor. And in the same way that members of the Atlanta Dream literally came out and protested their owners or one of their owners, the Senator Kelly Loeffler, the WNBA is making as bold a stance as there is in sports.
Here Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
We'll continue our conversation with acclaimed architect Frank Gehry about the state of architecture today and why he loves designing concert halls. That's next time on Here and Now.